You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lotte Hulst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network. Hello, and welcome to the Spark Parade, where I geek out with artists and entertainers about their cultural spark of inspiration. I'm Adam Unz. Thanks so much for joining me. It's still Pride Month. Yay! I've been chatting with a lot of incredible queer people this month. But we're gonna mix it up a little bit today, and I'm very excited about it. I had an amazing conversation with comedian Chris Gethard about his spark of inspiration, the John Cusack starring comedy Gross Point Blank. But it's also so much more than that. We talked about Chris's relationship with Judd Apatow, as well as Judd Apatow's films. We talked about Andy Kaufman. We talked about Cameron Crowe. We talked about comedy in general. Whew! It is a wide-ranging and very exciting and super fun conversation. Seriously, I really, really love this one, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So even though Chris isn't an LGBTQIA dude, he's an ally, and this conversation is such a fucking treat that I think it fits right into the celebratory nature of Pride. It's also a longer conversation than my usual chats, but I think that's a great thing. My friend Joel always whines when my episodes go over 30 minutes, so sorry, Joel, but tough shit. Anyway, let's get to it. Quick Chris facts. Chris Gethard is an actor, comedian, writer, and podcaster based out of New Jersey. He is a revered stand-up comedian, and his debut stand-up special, Chris Gethard Career Suicide, was released in 2017 on HBO. As an actor, Chris has appeared on The Office, Crashing, Broad City, Space Force, Parks and Rec, Inside Amy Schumer, and more. He is also the host of the critically acclaimed podcast Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People, where he opens the phone line to one anonymous caller and he can't hang up first, no matter what. His latest stand-up special, Chris Gethard Half My Life, was released on June 1st, followed by an album-specific release on June 4th, and you can watch or listen to it now on Apple TV, Amazon Prime Video, Spotify, and virtually every other entertainment platform known to humanity. And quick Gross Point Blank facts. Gross Point Blank is a 1997 black comedy crime film directed by George Armitage and starring John Cusack, Minnie Driver, Alan Arkin, and Dan Aykroyd. John Cusack plays an assassin who returns to his hometown to attend a high school reunion. And there you have it. Now, on to the exciting part. Here comes my chat with Chris Gethard about Gross Point Blank. So, the first question is always, do you remember seeing this movie for the first time?
I do. I mean, I saw it in the theater in northern New Jersey where I grew up. It was me and some high school friends. And from what I remember, it wasn't like we were all clamoring to see it. It was just kind of something that was out. I was a John Cusack fan from Say Anything. And the soundtrack, I think many people, even if they don't remember this movie, if they remember anything about it, they're like, oh yeah, killer soundtrack. So we all knew that it had like that throwback to a lot of the 80s stuff that, you know, there was so much 80s nostalgia then too. So yeah, I saw it in the theater, really loved it. And then I think when I realized how good it was I got a VHS copy while I was in college. And for people my age before, you know, I sound like, oh, back in my day, but like we didn't have streaming. So you had like six VHS tapes in your dorm room and you just watched those six movies over and over again. And then people would drop by, you'd be like, you want to watch this scene again? And for me, it was like the three I remember having were Pulp Fiction, Friday, and Gross Point Blank. Like those were the three VHS tapes that I had. So I wound up watching the movie like dozens of times.
Yeah. I have a lot of conversations about like the digital and analog divide and, you know, the feeling of like walking into video stores and like, you know, just casually perusing the offerings, seeing what's out there and not having limitless, almost overwhelming choices like we do now. And also like the idea of things not being available, like really wanting to see a movie on the day that it came out and it's like not available because everybody's already rented it. And that feeling of having a collection of movies and, you know, a finite amount of space where you live and you know, not infinite amount of money for most people. So really having to be selective and like just having the movies that you really love around you.
I think about that. I think about with rentals too, of how like you couldn't just watch the first 20 minutes and then if you like it, keep watching. And if you don't turn it off, try something else. Like this was your night. Like you drove there, you spent money, you don't have a backup option. So it meant something. I think a lot too, one that makes me laugh is like, how many movies I saw, like it was totally standard to just be flipping through the channels, land on a movie and be like, oh, I heard this was good, and just watch it from wherever it was at that point in the movie, knowing, oh, if I like it, I'll just go back. Like I saw the last 40 minutes of this movie and now I really like them. Let me go rent it so I can catch the first 25. It was like, that was another weird thing that's a good one that people will never have to do again. There's no curmudgeonly nostalgia for like, I watched the last 35 minutes of 3 o'clock High with commercials. It was pretty good. Let me see if I can go find the rest. Like that is a system that I think it's probably good that's gone.
Yeah. And also just remembering having to rewind movies before you brought them back and stuff. I worked at a movie store in high school and they had machines that just rewound movies and they had like six of them in a row so that, you know, whenever people brought them back and they didn't rewind things, they'd get charged like $1 or something for not rewinding. And yeah, I think in that respect, the digital age has significant advantages. But also just like with this particular movie, I think I remember it feeling really kind of unassuming as well. Like, you know, like something that I was interested in, but not something that I, you know, I didn't have any like preconceived notions of feeling like it was going to be something that I would really, really love. And I kind of feel that way about a lot of John Cusack movies, that I think it was a similar experience for me with Say Anything and maybe even with High Fidelity. I think maybe with High Fidelity at that point, I was like into his movies enough that it was like, maybe this is going to be another one that's like the ones that I've liked before. But with this one, I watched the trailer the other day and it's like a very 90s trailer anyway, but it gives absolutely nothing away. And it's just like, guns, fighting, high school reunion, ? The end. And that's it.
Yeah, I remember it feeling very under the radar, but pretty quickly, even in the theater, I was like, this movie's working for me hard. It's pushing a lot of buttons. And over the years, I've thought a lot about why, and I'm sure we'll get into it. But one thing that I really think this movie doesn't get enough credit for is I think like it's one of the best blends of like totally ham-fisted premise. Professional assassin goes to high school reunion. That's a pretty heavy comedy premise. That could go in a lot of ways. That could be an SNL sketch, you know? But then you look at the shocking amount of heart that this movie has without ever apologizing for that premise. And I think it really walks that line better than a lot of movies in general. And also, when you think about what comedy was leading up to 1997 and what you think about comedy was after, I sort of feel like that premise kind of sums up a lot of what comedy had been, but then the way it's delivered, I think, sort of points towards what like Apatow was about to do in the 2000s, where he goes, well, let's actually make it have some moments with heart, and that stuff that he became kind of, I think, legendary for, rightfully, and he's been a mentor to me. Like he starting with Freaks and Geeks, right? Legendarily, it was like, nope, we're going to wear it on our sleeve. This movie does that a few years prior to that. And certainly there had been movies that had, but I remember feeling like, oh, this is a wacky premise. And also there's some scenes where I'm like, my heart is kind of in my throat. And that was something that I think I really walked away with in my own career for sure, was seeing not just like having it both ways, but also understanding like you can mess with the audience's expectations if you kind of give yourself that wide a playing field. And I think this movie does that in a big way. It has like such hard jokes too, and then back to back with something where you go, oh my god, that's so real. And it's really cool that way.
Yeah. And I think that balance between like high concept wacky hijinks and really grounded funny but natural performances from John Cusack and from Minnie Driver as well, like really believing those characters and also not ignoring the complicated feelings that people have about adolescence, about being in high school, about looking back on that time in your life, the anxiety that people feel about like going to high school reunions if they're fucking crazy enough to do it. And yeah, just really making you feel like these characters are real people, even though the situation is heightened and a little bit unrealistic. But I think having that soundtrack, the music is pretty relentless throughout. Like it's just like hit after hit after hit. And it feels like even though it's constant, it doesn't feel intrusive. It complements the feeling of it and really gets you in the mindset of like, this is what his teenage years were like.
And certainly having one of the two main characters be a DJ helps with that. Very simple technique to get a lot of music in there where you can say what you want with the music. I love it. I love the jokes. Another thing that I think is very, because it's funny, you used the phrase John Cusack movie before, and that is kind of like a subgenre, right? Of 80s movies or romantic comedies. Like there's certain movies where you knew I'm seeing a John Cusack movie, and I was someone who was a fan of that. And you know, there's some of his movies that aren't John Cusack movies, especially now. And then back in the day, yeah, that one's a John Cusack movie. One of the things that I don't even think I realized how much I was taking away from this, but like the more you learned about him, the more you see it show up in his work in a real way. Like he is a legit super fan of The Clash, and how many movies this has Joe Strummer, this has The Clash. He's wearing Clash t-shirts in Say Anything, if I remember right. You find out that he, you know, the character in Say Anything's a kickboxer, but he was really into kickboxing. And then the guy he has the hallway fight, the guy who plays Felix La Poubelle, one of the best named characters I would argue ever, with one of the great scenes where he walks in, picks up the ID card and goes, "It is I, Sidney Feldman. Oh my, you've changed." Like that great gag. Yeah. That's his real life kickboxing instructor. That's Benny the Jet Urquidez, like this legendary kickboxer. You know, the amount of Chicago actors that are in this movie in particular, and you know he's a Chicago guy, he really loves Chicago. You got all these Second City legends, Alan Arkin, Barbara Harris plays his teacher, of course Dan Aykroyd, Second City, you got Jeremy Piven, you got his sister Joan, you know, I think one of his other sisters is like people spread all over in the reunion scene. So you get this sense of like, John Cusack takes care of his people. He loves Chicago. He loves The Clash. Weird. He likes kickboxing. And no matter how much, and he's a great actor. He's a very great, charming, likable, committed actor. But you also walk away feeling like, I feel like I get a sense that I would just like him. I get the sense that I know him. And it's another thing in my career that served me really well. Is just, I hit a certain point where I realized the number one thing I can do better than a lot of the people I came up with is just sort of like, be myself on stage and kind of wear my flaws and address my insecurities publicly and just kind of like put it all out there in a public way and kind of be emotionally naked, which is a very pretentious thing for a comedian to say. But I do realize there were a lot of things that influenced that, but it's easy to point to things like David Letterman and Howard Stern and Andy Kaufman, like the comedians, like the actual comedy output that I like, and go, yeah, I like their personality showing through. But Cusack did it in an entirely different way. He was still a committed actor, but you still got to walk away with that very important feeling of, I like that guy. I like that guy. And that's that's the John Cusack movies in quotation marks, right? That's Gross Point Blank, High Fidelity, Say Anything, probably Serendipity towards the tail end. Like, whereas I kind of feel like you watch like One Crazy Summer and you're like, I like John Cusack. I don't know if that's a John Cusack movie. And I think it's because it doesn't bleed through of like, oh, this guy feels things and has input and leaves his fingerprints on his work.
Right.
Sorry, I'm rambling, but I have a lot to say about this movie.
No, that's all great stuff. And it's like, you know, I think you could feel in really early movies when he was like a kid, The Sure Thing, and isn't he in 16 Candles
for
a little bit?
He is, yeah.
And in those movies, it's like you can see that he is injecting his personality into the characters that he plays, but he didn't have as much agency, as much clout in Hollywood. He didn't have the ability to really assert his personality, to like, you know, put his stamp on the stuff that he was doing. And as he gained more power, as he started, you know, getting involved in producing and that kind of stuff, you see those influences, the little bits of himself that he allows to kind of be a part of the characters that he's playing, but you still believe that it's not him. It's like, obviously he's not a hitman, but he plays them in a way, he plays these characters in a way that's like, you can imagine hanging out with him, even though the situation is extraordinary, he still feels like a real person.
And that's very rare for an actor, right? Like, I feel like you think about it, like you watch Tarantino, you get a sense of what Quentin Tarantino likes in real life. Like, you get, he likes, you know, here's the movies he's paying homage to, and man, does he like feet. Like, you walk away, you know that, you know? Like, you know, a totally different example, and not somebody who's critically lauded, but in his own way was very revolutionary. Like, Kevin Smith, like, love it or hate it. If there's one thing, whether it's Clerks, which everybody's like, wow, he did something cool, or whether it's one of those later ones, you go, I know who that guy is. He likes comic books and New Jersey and all these other things, but those are filmmakers, right? It's, John Cusack didn't direct Say Anything. Cameron Crowe did. Now, he co-wrote Gross Point Blank, if I remember right. So he was able to put his fingerprints on it more directly that way. But maybe that's part of why it is one that I hold so close to my vest, is because it's maybe the most bold-faced version of that. But yeah, I love it. And again, of course, just like to have a movie where you can have a scene as funny as like the two government agents tricking Dan Aykroyd into sitting in a toilet stall because they've convinced him he has to hide because the mark is about to catch them all talking. To have that's such a dumb gag. And then within a few scenes, have the main character realize his home has been bulldozed and his mom is in a mental hospital and he's been sending her money and he doesn't know where the money went. That's a heavy scene. You know, and then you follow it up later with he goes to the Quickie Mart that's where his old house was, and there's like this crazy cartoonish shootout where the guy working at the front desk has headphones on and is playing a video game so he doesn't hear like gunshots and like destruction. I'm like, you are bracketing gags with stuff that has so much heart. And actually, one scene that anytime I talk about this movie, there's one scene in it that I think is so brilliant. It's so brilliant where they never really mention his father, and there's a scene, kind of comes out of nowhere. There's nothing that leads up to it, and they sort of walk away from it, where it just cuts to him in a graveyard. This very sort of slow, like introspective-sounding Joe Strummer song is playing. He stands in front of a tombstone with his dad's name on it, dumps a bottle of whiskey entirely, drops the bottle, and walks away. You go, I don't know that I've ever seen a relationship explained so succinctly in a film. I mean, there's one actor, and I feel like I just learned everything I need to know about that character's entire relationship with his father. And he didn't say a word. And the thing he was acting against was a tombstone. And just through the tone and the simple choices, they tell you so much. I sit there, I go, wow, wow. You know, and then it's the same movie where there's two guys pointing guns at each other under a dining table. And when the waitress tells John Cusack what he ordered isn't an omelet, he has a line like, I don't want to debate semantics, I just need the protein. And you're like, how? You're having it both ways in this movie in a way I really love. You are not scared to push and pull it in any direction that you choose. It's really, for a thing that on the surface feels like a gaggy comedy, there's a lot more underneath it, and that proved very aspirational to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's super tight. It's like there really isn't anything that's throwaway. Everything means something. And in rewatching it, my memories of like that shootout at the end, to me, that was like a third of the movie. Like, I mean, and part of it was just like being a kid and thinking that, you know, shootouts are cool or whatever, but it's quick. It's like 2 minutes or something. And the end of the movie, everything is tied up really quickly as well. But nothing feels rushed. It doesn't feel like that is an unnatural way for things to end. And also the stuff that you were saying about this almost, I think, completely wordless thing in the graveyard and just like explaining his entire relationship with his father in this very subtle way. There's a lot of stuff that's unspoken about like the relationship between his character and Minnie Driver's character, and you understand so much about them just like seeing the house that she grew up in and the interaction that he has with his mother and that moment in the graveyard. It's like you understand so much about what has gone on between the two of them, and they don't say anything about it.
And you get why he had such massive insecurity that she had such a blind spot to, where she's going, I got this life of affluence and relatively carefree, and you know, this father who kind of dotes on me, and then you've got a mother with mental problems and an alcoholic dad, and clearly this was a kid going, I don't know, you know, all the dots you just laid out, you can connect it, that she can't see that he just went, I don't know how to be in love with, I don't know how to settle down at the age of 18. I have not seen this work. I haven't seen it. And none of that needs to be said. It's not some dramatic monologue. And I love that you brought up the shootout scene at the end, because this movie is bracketed, if you look at it, first of all, one of the great opening scenes, I would argue, in a movie ever. And it ties right back into that last one, where that opening scene where he's on the phone with Joan Cusack and she's reading the invitation to the reunion. And meanwhile, he's walking in an empty apartment with a sniper rifle, tracking this guy on the bike, takes him out. She's just in between every step of, like, the assassinations are so rote and this is just their day job that they could just read it. He doesn't even need to focus on the killing. He can hear her reading it. So funny. Takes her out. Dan Aykroyd comes out, snakes the job. So sets up everything you need to know. Okay, this guy is this badass. He's high school reunion, all that, right? And then at the end, the shootout you mentioned, really, really similar, right? But the complete evolution of the character. He's no longer saying, don't even read this to me, throw that away, stop reading it. He now is actually in the middle of a shootout killing people while explaining who he is. Honestly, for the first time to this girl he's always loved, she's completely shell-shocked. But to him, again, I'm just killing people, but I also want to let you know, like, here's who I am, and I've actually really been thinking about blah, 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 our relationship, and blah, 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 maybe I can finally take a chance. And now he's accepted that he needs this growth, and he's accepted that he does have this last-minute ability to change. Mirrors the beginning so well, and then again, so emotional, right? And then he hits that point of really laying it out that he wants to be with her after everybody's dead. And this punchline, I love things that have an unapologetic punchline, and just the dad poking his head out from the bathtub and going, you got my blessing. I'm like, you have it always. You have this shootout with this emotional speech. Dan Aykroyd, and this I would argue is actually probably, like, Dan Aykroyd had already hit a lull, and then he went into vodka Crystal Skull Dan Aykroyd after this. And this, I feel like they squeezed out one last great performance from Dan Aykroyd. Great performance. He's got all these funny lines in it. There's all these funny moments, and it's all overlaid with this emotional speech. And then it hits the emotional high point, and then you get a punchline like that. I'm like, honestly, how do you even write that? How do you even include all that? And what you said is a 2-minute stretch. It's some of the hardest laughs I got. It's some of the stuff where it's the most tender. And then it wraps up with this killer punchline that doesn't feel hacky. I just go, man, this was pretty inspired. This writing team was pretty inspired for a lot of this movie. And those things in particular, you just don't get them. You just don't get them all the time. And with no fat on the bones. And most of this movie, fat-free. It's really, really impressive.
Time for a quick break, because somebody's got to keep the lights on around here. But we'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And, you know, there are moments of broader comedy, but for the most part, even the Joan Cusack and Dan Aykroyd, who are like the closest to kind of chewing scenery, although they're both brilliantly cast, they both like are amazing in this, you still believe those characters and you just believe that they're kind of a little louder than like the John Cusack character and the Minnie Driver character. They're a little broader as people. And then also, yeah, just having, it's like, it's the whole movie is quick. It moves really, the pacing is really speedy, but there's still room for those more emotional, kind of thoughtful, introspective touches. And it does, those don't feel rushed either. It's like, that's at the center of the movie. It's kind of about taking stock of your life, thinking of the things that you regret, the anxiety that people feel about, you know, going to high school reunions and worrying about, you know, interacting with people they haven't seen for a long time because of whatever, like not even about, you know, abandoning your girlfriend and joining the army and becoming a hitman, but like, you know, when he gets to the reunion and having these like kind of awkward interactions and you see all these like people that you recognize from your high school experience, like, you know, the overeager, like A student who's the one who's checking people in, and, you know, the kind of bully gone to seed, and
who reveals that he loves poetry, who reveals he's always, yeah, like, it's just like, yeah, oh, give that to me, give me that hallway scene.
Yes.
And Cusack, yeah, begrudgingly takes the time to be like, fine, read your poem, like I'll listen to the poem. It's really great, Bob. You want to hear the rest? No, I think I get it, Bob. We're going to move. It's so good.
Yeah. And that's another one of my favorite moments, is just, you know, the drunk bully saying, oh, I'm gonna fucking punch you, and he's just like, listen, there is nothing between us. We're not going to fight. There's no reason for us to fight. We don't have a thing. And it's just like, it's beautiful. And it totally diffuses, like, he's just, it's like, so disarmed by that.
I wish, like, it's funny because, like, as far as how this movie's inspired me, I think a lot of stuff in my career has been very contradictory to each other. Like, I had this public access show that a lot of people first found about me, and that show was completely insane, but it had a lot of moments of heart in it, and some that I actually hold close to my chest as some of my favorite moments from the show. And then my HBO special was like this thing about depression and suicide, where a lot of comedians were like, is this even comedy? And me going, well, there's a lot of laughs in it and I kind of don't care. And then I have this podcast and I have this frustrating career for myself where people keep finding out about me through different things, and their perception of me is as a completely different artist than the people who know me through something else. And then the podcast has gotten like really intensely serious overall. And people have revealed to me, you know, we just do phone calls and people have revealed some brutally intense things, but in every episode, I feel like more often than not, I do manage to find at least one hard laugh. And I sit there, I go, man, maybe if my career was a little easier to define, or maybe if my brain worked in a way where I just wanted to do one thing, or I was more content to just try to like write a pilot and go pitch it, maybe it would make more sense to people. Maybe I'd feel like I had firmer footing. But I look at it and I go, well, the commonality is that I go, I want stuff that feels insane, and I want stuff that feels funny, and I also want I also want to kind of let people know where my head's at and who I am. And I'm very willing to just kind of like tinker with adjusting the dials on the level of which of those things show up between like the insanity and the comedy and the heart. And I look at it, I go, oh, it all makes sense to me. It's like all, but it doesn't really make sense to a lot of other people, but it's rooted in a few things. And I think Gross Point Blank might be the least obvious one. There was a moment on my old TV show, if I may, where we had this, and it's public access TV. So anybody who knows Polyisis TV knows, like, the whole thing, the whole vibe of this is that it's going to be nuts. Like, this is every show on public access is either, like, conspiracy theories, local politics, and the local politics shows I actually think serve an amazing purpose, and kudos to public access TV. It's an underrated service, or complete insane. Every show, just lunacy, a lot of lunacy. And we did an episode called Belly Burrito, where I sat on a table, I laid down on a table wrapped in saran wrap, and the audience was able to call in and pick out ingredients to add to a burrito being built on my belly. And then we were going to have an audience member volunteer to eat it at the end. One of the dumbest premises we've ever thought of in over 200 episodes of admittedly insane public access television. But because I do try to speak honestly, John Cusack let us know he liked The Clash. He liked kickboxing. He loved Chicago. I always would kind of wear what my current interests were and my background on my sleeve. And this guy calls up. He goes, you know, I heard a few episodes back, you like kind of offhandedly mentioned that you recently like switched medications for your mental health stuff. Like, he's like, I know that it's kind of weird to ask in the midst of all this, but like, how did you know it was time? And, I'm laying on a table wrapped in saran wrap with like tortillas and like chopped peppers and sour cream all over me. And I go, well, you know, because in my mind, I'm going, I'm not scared of a serious moment. I'm just not. I know that they can balance. I sit there and I'm like, well, you know, like I was struggling through this and I started to feel like some things were slipping and I felt myself hiding things from loved ones. And that's a huge warning sign. And the guy just interrupts me and he goes, oh, cool. You got any salsa? And it was a prank. And he set me up and cut me off. And I just went, man, like, I'm very willing to go there. And even though my stuff is kind of cult, it's attracting the other people who, like that person who was on the phone, either already loves or would love Gross Point Blank. I know that. I just know that because they understood that moment. So I don't want to make it too much about myself, but I sit there, I go, wow, like I didn't know when I wandered into a theater in 1997, just because I was like, oh, John Cusack's in it and it has Violent Femmes on the soundtrack. I didn't know that I was still going to be thinking about it like 2.5 decades later, but I do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the parallels there are that funny, what is funny, I think that the funniest stuff in the world comes from a place that people can relate to and that's grounded in real experience. And sometimes real experiences are sad, they suck, and life isn't perfect, and people have more, you know, like people aren't funny all the time. People aren't happy all the time.
Yes.
And understanding those like peaks and troughs. And that's something that this movie does really well. And I think that's something that John Cusack does really well. And also just being able to like say who you are on stage is not who you are in everyday life, but it's a version of you.
Yes.
And you are injecting your life into what you're doing. And that's what makes it relatable. That's what makes people want to come back, is because they can see that you're letting them in. And it's not all the way in, but it's like you're letting them see parts of you.
I think that is so astute. It is a succinct version of the thing I've been rambling this whole time. So thank you for it. And just the thing I want to underline is like, coming from a comedy background, I know that there's a lot of comedy fans and even comedians who go, yeah, but it's fake comedy. It needs more punchlines. And I go, well, actually what I would argue is that like having a gag, for example, like where Cusack and Aykroyd, where Aykroyd starts listing which other assassins are joining his union. And they just all sound so weird and funny. And it kind of builds to the point where they describe one that is a two-person team where one of them is a little person. And their catchphrase is Queens of the Hotel Hit. You just sit there, you go, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? But I feel like rather than view things through a lens where you go, is comedy sort of selling out by then inserting sadness into it? I actually go, in my viewpoint, what happens is you are giving your audience the comedy you promised. And that is this sort of unspoken contract that lets them know the sad parts here are not meant to be performative or exploitative. And I think that that is why the Apatow wave that came later appealed to me so greatly. Seeing like some of the brutally heartbreaking scenes in Freaks and Geeks, you know, like that scene where I think it's at the end of one of the episodes where they've just shown Bill take it on the chin all day, but there's so much funny stuff, obviously. And then they have that scene at the end where he just goes home and he sits in front of his TV and Gary Shandling's doing stand-up and he's just like sitting there with his goofy laugh and his mouth full and you just sit there, you go, oh, he's like finding this comfort after this day of pain. I go, the fact that I've laughed so many times in this episode is actually why I'm willing to sit here and watch this, because there's other shows where I think they come up with, they go, let's write a show that's about X, Y, and Z, and it's an issue-driven thing, and you can tell that that was the priority. And to me, I go, you're manipulating your audience in a way that seems a little unfair to me. If you're making comedy from the perspective of it will be about pain, I sit there and I go, if you want to use comedy as the delivery system for those discussions, it has to still be about jokes, because that is the service to the audience. And if that service is provided well enough, you now have the right to throw some stuff in there that turns some other gears in their mind. So I really, you know, it's one of the things, I actually really love true crime. And this wave of true crime the past few years, I've been soaking it all up and I love it. But there is certainly an argument to be made for some of this stuff is just its own version of pornography. It is prioritizing everything but the humanity, finding the most disturbing imagery to give the audience who's seeking this like a dopamine hit. But that almost feels like, I hate to use a weird analogy, but it feels like this coke is cut with a lot of other bad stuff. You know what I mean? Like, this is not pure. They're throwing in embalming fluid and baby powder. Like, this is, and I can feel that with a lot of genres. And with comedy, I think I sniff it out really hard because I'm someone, I work so hard with my HBO special to go, if the funny parts are not as funny as the stuff I do on stage that's just jokes that have nothing to do with depression, I'm not going to do this show. Mm. The jokes about this stuff need to get laughs as big as my joke about visiting a gator-themed amusement park.
Yeah.
If the jokes about, you know, side effects of medication or times I've tried to hurt myself don't get laughs that big, then I am exploiting the audience's pain and trying to convince them this is art that it is not. So, like I said, a handful of things that play into that, but the Queens of the Hotel hit, You Got My Blessing, the protein line, you know, just the line that makes me laugh so hard. Like, he's driving with Jeremy Piven. Jeremy Piven goes, ah, Debbie's house. Yeah. Really snuck up on us, didn't it? No, you drove us here. Like, things like that. Where I go, those are the things that make me then so happy to sit back and go, he's holding up a baby at his high school reunion and you see him thinking, oh, he never says it, but you just see him having all those emotions we all have at some point where you go, I convinced myself I didn't want kids and now a friend my age who was a real friend has one and I'm holding it and I'm going, oh, I think those were all excuses. I think I was scared.
Yeah.
Maybe I want a kid, but I've backed myself into a corner with this life I lead that I don't really like. And I was like the cool, subversive, counterculture kid in high school. And now I am a living representation of how cutthroat capitalism can be. Fuck. You go, oh, wow. And obviously you're not sitting in the theater eating your popcorn, crystallizing the thoughts that way. But you sit there and you go, man. And then like two scenes later is him and Jeremy Piven wrapping a body in a banner about like the fucking bake sale or whatever it was and throwing the body in a furnace. You go, man, they're allowing me to ponder life's great complexities. And I don't even have to sit here and feel pretentious because I'm just seeing a comedy, man. It's really awesome. It's really awesome.
And I mean, going back to what you were saying about Judd Apatow as well, and I think comparison between his stuff and this movie that's a good one. It's like earning the silliness, earning the broader stuff, because you have a grounded framework. You believe these characters, and like that moment where they're listing off all the different hitmen, it isn't like, you know, waka waka. They're not pushing it so hard that it feels like it's taking you out of the moment. It's just like, these are, yeah, it's crazy that, you know, there's all these different kinds of hitmen, but they're real people we know. And John Cusack comments about them where he's just like, oh yeah, he's mean, or, you know, yeah, whatever.
I don't like that.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so good.
Right. Yeah.
And little things too. Just so many lines that are like that. Like when Joan Cusack's character goes, oh, we got this new job proposed. It would be so easy. It's a Greenpeace boat. John Cusack just, I have scruples. You're like,
yes.
Just the way they so, just this world of, it's similar to me of like them reacting to all the characters of the assassin world you never meet, of the same thing of like, what are the ethics and standards of being an assassin, and seeing how some of them have them and some of them don't. I'm like, it's so funny. It's like they suggest this world of just this ludicrous world of constant death. But yeah, where they all know each other the same way that most people know the guy who works in accounting, and you don't know him that well, but like you get a bad vibe. Like that's how they treat the queens of the hotel hit. Like it's so funny to me.
Yeah, and also the relationship between John Cusack and Dan Aykroyd. It is like, oh, fucking Gary from Accounts, who, yes, you know, always, yes, microwaves tuna. I can't, oh, I just don't want to talk to him.
Yeah, and with his beer belly and his tucked in shirt. That
right, like, oh, right.
He's like, he's exactly that guy. He's exactly that guy. It's really great. It's really great. And you know what's so funny too that I'm only thinking about now is as Judd's reputation built into, I think, being like, I mean, I think history will remember him, like pop culture history will remember him as like, here's this guy who put his complete, who like worshipped Gary Shandling and then took the stuff Gary Shandling took him and just in the most mainstream way ever, like took over with this stuff that evolved comedy. Like he has that feather in his cap. But if you look at his career as it became more and more cemented, it's analyzed in a way that's exactly what we're talking about, where reviewers are so shark-like in saying, like, you look at his movie, like, This Is 40, I think, got some bad reviews, and so many people going, ah, he made it too long, and the long stuff isn't the funny stuff, you know? And that's what people pick apart with his stuff with a fine-tooth comb, and it really is that, the balance, like, you know, I guess you could call it like the sad clown ratio. What is it? Is it 52% clown? Because then we'll go with you. We'll take 48% sad. But you better, if it goes even down to 50-50, we're gonna get you on it. But if you get it up to 58% funny to sad, now we're really talking. But if it gets up to 65, leave the sad stuff out. You're milking our pain. It's like such a weird thing that his career actually, I think, shows how people came to analyze this thing that Gross Point Blank, I keep arguing, is sort of like a proto version of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I, while we've been talking, I was thinking about Knocked Up and like the, you know, a kind of broader 80s idea of the same thing where it's like a boy meets a girl and a mistake happens, like, you know, turning it into something where it's like a caper. And what the reality of this movie, that movie is that it's like real people, real characters thinking about how people would feel in that situation. And the funny stuff comes because life can be funny. There are funny situations in everybody's day where you just, you know, maybe it's something that somebody does that's funny that they don't think is funny and you laugh at it, or like you, you know, mm-hmm. kind of giggle to yourself and don't let them know or whatever. But it's all, it's not like watching an old fashioned like vaudeville show or something. Yes. It's yes. You know, it feels real. You believe that those people are real people.
And it's funny, 'cause I feel like if you asked a lot of people, they'd go, that movie was really funny, man. But I bet I'm not the only one where if you said to me, what's the scene you remember? I bet I'm not the only one who goes, her just begging him to read the baby books. Just being like, read the books. Like that breaking point. That's the one I remember most. Whereas Superbad, also from Judd's, you know, oeuvre, am I pronouncing it right? I'm not smart enough.
Yes.
You go, that's almost the opposite, right? A similar thing. 80s premise, these kids got to find the booze for the big party. Like, that is very, that's 16 Candles. That's like, that's cut from so many 80s movies. And then that one, I remember the gags. I remember Jonah Hill getting hit by the car. Obviously, the McLovin stuff. The discussion, all the Bill Hader and McLovin stuff and Joe Latrulia, like you remember the gags for that, but then you also remember that scene at the end where I think Jonah Hill gets on the escalator and kind of floats away. You go, oh, the whole time this movie was about friends realizing that their lives are going to be different moving forward, like, and not just different from the standards, but like, oh, we're going to move in different directions. And everybody has their hometown friends like that. I went to state school. And I remember my good friends who went to the really posh liberal arts schools. I remember my friends who didn't go to college or went to community college. And I remember, you know, you get a year or two into college, you go, I haven't heard from those people. And you go, oh, because life kind of sucks and there's weird classism and we just got pointed in totally different directions. And I wonder if we are ever going to be friends the way we were. Oh shit, we're not. And that's what Superbad is ultimately about. But that what I remember is Bill Hader being like, McLovin, you know what? You're cool, man. Let's go. Let's run some red lights and go get drunk. Like, you're like, oh, it's they. So many of those Judd movies find the right balance for that premise and that personnel and those actors, and really remarkable. Really, let alone 40-year-old virgin, which kind of kicked it all off, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the hacky 80s premise is the title of the movie.
Right.
And then what do you remember from that? You remember, I feel like Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen clowning on each other in that store with stuff that, let me be clear, a lot of homophobic stuff that I'm sure those people would not put in one of their own movies today. Right. And then you remember the Catherine Keener. You remember Catherine Keener just being so gentle with Steve Carell, mm-hmm. and like easing him into the growth of the character. You go, that's what I remember. And, I've tried to emulate that even with my more sort of like experimental performance arty stuff. And then when Judd, you know, I was so lucky. Judd, when I was doing the show that became my HBO special, Judd actually heard about it and reached out to me. He was kind of like this angel that came out of nowhere. And I don't know that I've like put this out there too many times, but in a way that I think he doesn't care about probably at all, but I do immensely. I'm like, everything I do moving forward, even the things he is not involved in, I would like to make him proud because this is a style that has always meant a lot to me. And yeah. And then you start to map it where like I was so obsessed with Andy Kaufman as a kid. And then I start to go, how can I like Andy Kaufman so much when he was like a trickster who never broke character? But then my favorite movies are the ones where the characters are so real. And I go, well, what Andy was ultimately doing in one sense, and the sense that's affected me the most, is you go, he always made them laugh, but then sometimes he just like really pissed people off. Like wrestling women was funny, but there's a whole book that exists now just of the hate mail he got to. Like people were really mad. Like the Great Gatsby bit, if you know about that one, he actively made them as bored as they've ever been. And then the punchline is huge, you know, like the Mickey Mouse bit, so confusing, or Mighty Mouse rather, so confusing, undeniably also really funny, but you're perplexed. So he was actually, I think, very masterful at saying, I'll give you the laughs. I'll give you the laughs you paid your money for. You're going to feel other things along the way, though. And during his time, there was no one else. That's why people look at him and go, man, he is so weird. There was no one else. I think literally no one else doing anything close to what he was doing. And those comics from that era, I'm lucky in the world of stand-up that every once in a while, I still meet somebody who saw him live or worked on a project with him, and I get to pick their brain. And they're still confused by him. And I am too. I'm not going to claim I'm not, but the thing I admire, like he did, one of the things he did that's lesser known is he did this show at Carnegie Hall where he was already on Taxi at the time. And he did all the bits, the conga drums and Elvis and Tony Clifton, all the stuff that people loved. And then the show ended where he brought out the Rockettes and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and then Santa Claus lowered from the ceiling. And then he said, hey, there's school buses out front. Anybody who wants milk and cookies, get on the buses. And I look and I go, so much of him is viewed as like this antagonist and this guy who put negativity into his audience's lives. And then there's this Carnegie Hall example that he actually made an attempt to end their evening with like a complete sense of euphoria, like childlike euphoria, literally Santa Claus and milk and cookies. I go, oh, that's... In my mind, that is in a weird way exactly what Judd does, poured into an entirely different container. So I think too hard about this stuff.
Yeah, but it's all like different roads to the same destination. And, you know, saying that comedy is not a monolith. There's just all of these different kinds of comedy. People come at comedy from all different perspectives. But at least to my mind, the best comedy, the comedy that really sticks with you, is not just one thing. It's a bunch of different things.
I think so.
And the emotional content is hilarious. You are pissed off sometimes. There's bittersweet moments. There's moments that are really upsetting. And it's, again, it just comes back to you. That's life. That's why even with something like Andy Kaufman stuff that's like really bizarre, sometimes really abstract, there's still this vast emotional life that exists in it. And I think that's the through line. That's the common thing with all these movies we've been talking about, all these comics we've been talking about, these filmmakers, that they get that it's like you have to reflect the complexities of life to really connect with an audience and to really get your message across, regardless of what that message is.
It's Cameron Crowe, I think, is another.
Totally.
Who obviously Say Anything is the crossover, but you look at the 80s movies and I mean, wacky stuff, right? Like claymation inserted in the middle, and like all the teen movies had that, and like this wackiness. And then also I always forget to admit, like when I was a kid, probably my favorite movies were like the Police Academy series, just like ham-fisted gags. And one thing I really admire, because if I remember right, Cameron Crowe, he wrote but didn't direct Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And a lot of people look at Fast Times at Ridgemont High and go, that's the pinnacle of just that like raw, get the last 80s comedies that I miss, right? And then you look at it, you go, well, actually, for all the Spicoli stuff and Aloha, Mr. Hand and Order in the Pizza to Class and for all that stuff, there's also a pretty intense scene about a girl getting an abortion. Where you go, man, Cameron Crowe, like, and obviously 16 Candles and Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink had their moments of emotion, but I would argue you look at those 80s movies and you go, Cameron Crowe was willing to go to, I'm going to, you know, my brother's going to realize that I need an abortion. Like that is a cut deeper, I would argue, than most of what those wacky comedies were willing to give us. And again, I would point out, not a lot of people with Fast Times actually remember it as one of the funniest, gaggiest ones, which ties right into the thing I keep thinking about and talking about, which is like, you're remembering it as one of the funniest ones, but I can't help but wonder if that's also because it sits in your gut as one of the rawest emotional ones, but you forget that scene. Every time I rewatch that movie, I do have that thing where I go, I forgot about that. Jesus, I forgot about that. I just like the thing where Spicoli messes up the car. You know what I mean? Like I remember that.
Yeah.
But I can't help but wonder if that's part of why it's remembered as the funniest as well. I think in a lot of people's opinions.
Right. Yeah. And like, you know, even with the broader stuff in that movie, like you said, there's this, you know, it feels like real situations that people experience. And then moving into Say Anything and maybe even Singles, like those movies having these really funny moments, definitely feeling like you can understand why people would lump those films into put them in the comedy section in the video store.
Yeah.
But also having like the stuff with John Mahoney, you know, like defrauding all yeah. of the people in the nursing home.
Defrauding
and all
the elderly who rely on him. You're like, oh my God.
And it's really heavy and feels real.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, makes you come back to those movies, is the combination of the perfect like comedic timing, having all these really talented actors, you know, people and like Lily Taylor and people like that playing these smaller parts, but really just, yeah. And actually that whole subplot where, you know, she's writing these fucking ridiculous songs about this boy.
Joe lies when he cries.
But she tried to kill herself.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, striking that balance again.
And all her friends are like quietly concerned in the way that you are when you have a friend that you realize is going down that road. And Cameron Crowe too. It's like, and some of his movies, you know, he really, like, I missed the boat on Jerry Maguire. I didn't see it when it came out. I don't know why, you know, I was young and didn't have the time or money to see every movie and everybody. And it was one of those ones that I was like, oh, I got to see that. And I never did. And I just always knew that, obviously, as someone who hadn't seen it, I know that as what? The Show Me the Money movie. That's what I know it is. Oh, I guess I'll go watch this movie about a sports agent who's crazy. I'm telling you, I watched that movie and legitimately came moments away from proposing to someone who I'd been seeing for years and who I ultimately realized it was a very unhealthy relationship for me. I go, man, that movie, I thought that was Show Me the Money. And that almost made me marry somebody I shouldn't have. That's powerful stuff. And then Almost Famous, which is definitely more of a drama at that point. but still has so many funny parts. And then that beautiful scene that I think only Cameron Crowe would write of, he tried to trade you for a case of beer, and then Kate Hudson just pauses. And it, I think one of the, a line that broke my heart maybe more than, as much as any other, you know, we've seen her just going, what kind of beer?
Oh,
am God. I Bud Light or am I Heineken? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, is it is it from a craft brewery or is it Natty Light? You just go. But it's the people with the funny brains that can often, right? Which then ties into all the stuff that I think is a little nonsense of like, oh, you have to be in pain to be funny. And a lot of people are. And I can't pretend I'm not, but I go, oh, there is something to be said for the people who can explain that pain the best can also give us the joke, like the guy revealing his sexuality during the plane crash, you know, like the people who can nail both of those in a crystallized way. You know, we've named Judd and Cameron Crowe, and there's a lot of other people too, especially after the 2000s, when I think Judd made that okay and like commendable and actually hot and buzzworthy. But it's the people who can verbalize something real in a crystal clear way and then put a punchline that makes you laugh. And again, one of the tropes that is very true, laughter is involuntary. You know, you don't get to opt into laughter. And then that's why sometimes you're laughing at a thing where you go, ooh, that is inappropriate. I should not be liking this, but I do, I guess. And it's the people who can make you laugh in that involuntary way and then also come up with the what kind of beer line where I go, these are the people who I probably quietly consider heroes as a creative person, yeah. You know?
I think that is a lovely note to finish on. My God, this has been so amazing. Really,
oh,
really
good. Because I will tell you, I've been sitting in my head this whole time going, I'm steamrolling this and rambling too much, and I feel bad.
The opposite.
That's how I feel every time I do.
The exact opposite. This is the good stuff. This is exactly what I'm looking for. So thank you so much. I really appreciate this. This is going to be a classic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's been a joy, and I actually will say, aspects of it where I go, oh, these are a lot of things I kind of knew about myself and my opinions that I've never had the opportunity to just like bounce so directly off. And then, like I was joking, you're also able to say things where I go, oh, that's what I mean. That's that thing. That's what I mean. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
Cool.
Again, thank you so much. This was absolutely amazing.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Take care. Bye.
I'll see you.
I mean, come on. That was incredible. Thanks so much again to Chris for being so generous with his time and for that totally amazing conversation. You can stream and download his new special, Chris Gethard, Half My Life, right now. So do it. Okay, I know we're running long this week, so super quick spark of inspiration from me. Since it's still Pride Month and Black Music Month, I want to talk about one of my faves, Sid, aka Sid the Kid. She was a member of the Odd Future Music Collective. She's a member of the band The Internet, who I also love. But I want to talk about Sid's solo album, Finn. Fiend? Finn? Let's say Finn. She talked about it kind of derisively and basically said it was a way to make money to support the music that The Internet were making, which is still her main focus. But I really love this album. It's a lot poppier than the internet stuff, and it reminds me of a lot of the pop R&B that I love the most, like Aaliyah and TLC, that kind of stuff. So check that out this week. And that's about it. Please do me a solid and tell your friends about this show. It really helps to get the word out. Other than that, it's NYC Pride this weekend. It's going to be great. If you are in the city, have so, so, so much fun. Be careful. Look out for yourself. And until next time, bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.